Hello, it's Thursday, September the 23rd. This is the Andrew Pearce Show, and it's coming as ever from the Daily Mail newsroom. Coming up, did you see that fabulous documentary on Prince Philip with 15 members of the royal family talking to the camera? It was presented by our very own Robert Harbin, who joins me shortly. Also, Scotland is going drug-free. If you're caught in possession of cannabis, heroin or cocaine, you're not going to be subjected to a criminal charge. Insulate Britain. You know my view of them? Not very high. Well, there's now talk that they could be banned from every single motorway in the United Kingdom via the courts. But first, a poll for the Daily Mail suggests a staggering, not so staggering really, 83% of us say we want traditional in-person consultations with our GP. Are you listening, Secretary of State for Health? Are you listening, Prime Minister? 83%. 85% of us think we should be entitled to an in-person appointment with a GP. That's according to a new poll for the Daily Mail by JL Partners. More than half, 53%, say they struggle to obtain face-to-face appointments, with nearly 3 in 10, 27%, who've asked to see their GP in person in the past year saying they've been told no. I'm joined now by Tom Lubbock, who is a director at JL Partners, who conducted this poll. Tom, 85% think we should be entitled to an in-person appointment. I'm amazed it's not 100%.
Well, I think it's a very, very strong, resounding finding for the Daily Mail's campaign, really, to get people in-person appointments. There is that tiny minority, I think, probably of younger people we found in the poll, who are actually really quite keen on this new remote system. But as you say, the overwhelming majority really want to see their GP face-to-face, don't they?
They do. And, of course, this comes after the chairman of the Royal College of GPs suggested, because of high demand, it's impossible for family doctors to offer an in-person appointment just because people would like one.
Yeah, and we actually found there's a significant chunk of people who have explicitly asked for an in-person appointment. It's about 30% of those who ask for an in-person appointment could not actually get one. Their GP practice would not give them one, and they got an alternative or got no appointment. And also, we found that people generally think that it is very difficult to contact their GP at the moment. About 64% of people said, it's difficult to contact my GP at the moment. So it's not a good picture.
No, and of course, also, often you can't get beyond the ferocious receptionist at the GP surgery. And if you speak to 111, Tom, they're not clinically trained, the people who answer the phones at 111.
Yeah, and we actually asked people what kind of help they wanted to receive. Who did they want to see? And overwhelmingly, people wanted to see their named GP. And that was actually more popular with people over the age of 65. They want that continuity of service. Our poll shows that they really want to see that family GP that the Mail campaign has pushed so strongly for.
Do you think, you do polls all the time, Tom. It's very unusual, isn't it, to get such a strong and overwhelming margin in favour of one question. 85% say we should be entitled to an in-person appointment. Do you think it's going to make any, will it make any difference? Will they be sitting up and reading this in number 10?
I think they should be. I mean, all aspects of the campaign received very high levels of support. And there was actually one which received stratospheric support that I don't think I've ever seen, which is, there should be an end to a postcode lottery in terms of whether you can or can't see your GP in person. It was, I think, 95% of people said that it shouldn't matter where you live, you should be able to see your GP in person, or at least it should be equally likely that wherever you live, you get an in-person appointment rather than one of these remote appointments. And that speaks to the British public sense of fairness. It always comes through in this kind of research.
Yeah, absolutely. Tom, it's fascinating, the poll. When did you last see your doctor, Tom? Or are you a healthy man who doesn't need to see the GP?
I actually took my daughter for a flu vaccine, and funnily enough, we had to sort of break into the surgery because it's now so hard to get into the doctor's surgery. Even if you're booked in to see a nurse or a GP, you have to ring a buzzer and try and raise someone. So an interesting anecdote, that, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. It speaks volumes, doesn't it? That's Tom Lubbock. He's a director at JL Partners who've conducted that poll. So just to remind you, 85% of us, according to that poll by JL Partners, say we should be entitled to an in-person appointment with a GP. And I, for one, agree 100%. Visit mailplus.co.uk to listen to The Andrew Pearce Show for free and in full, along with our other podcasts and our video series. Remember to tell your Alexa speaker to play Daily Mail News. The Insulate Britain activists who've caused chaos on roads this week could be banned from the entire motorway network. And I say, can't happen quick enough. Government lawyers are examining whether to apply for the sweeping powers, which could also see protesters locked up. An interim injunction has already been granted, banning them from the M25. I'm joined now by Susan Hall. She's the leader of the Conservative group on the Greater London Assembly. Susan, is that music to your ears that they could be banned from the entire motorway network?
Absolutely. Absolutely. What they're doing is an utter disgrace. I'm in agreement with you, Andrew. That you can't come quick enough. And I mean, I read on the online mail that somebody said, if they put us in prison for years, then we have won. What an idiot.
Yeah.
An absolute idiot. I mean, these people.
And it's not just the injunction applies to the M25. So, of course, there's the fear that they could target other motorways, Susan. But is your beef with them that they're potentially endangering other people's lives every time they run onto a motorway?
That's the main reason I'm so cross. And I do believe they've done something on the M11 and M3. There's a big difference. Extinction Rebellion are hideous in many ways with what they do as well. But they block off roads. But people can get out of their vehicles and maybe walk a few streets away and hail a cab if they need to get to hospital, etc. When you are stuck on a motorway, as all your listeners will know, you are stuck. You can't go anywhere. It's highly dangerous what they're doing. Unforgivable, to be honest. And the other reason I'm so cross is if you look at the cost of Extinction Rebellion, £50 million, wasted police time and resource. We need our police officers actually fighting crime, not trying to unstick these idiots from the road.
Yeah, and of course, one of the other problems that we've all become aware of, people unable to get to hospital. There was the very well-known story now of Chris, who was driving his mum, trapped for 6 hours on the M25. She had a stroke and is now paralysed down one side. And the doctor said if he'd got there in the normal time the journey should have taken, her symptoms would have been minimal.
I know. It was absolutely shocking to hear that. And it goes back to, as I said, it's one thing blocking off a road, which I don't approve of anyway, any roads. But at least if you could get out of your car or get somebody else to you. But on a motorway, you've got one great big traffic jam. Nobody can go anywhere. And that's what is what makes it that much more dangerous.
And what about the idea that they should be beginning to look about criminal sanctions against them, i.e. they go to, because currently I think the police bail them and they're back on the motorway the next day, ridiculous. Do you think they should be banged up in prison?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And I believe it's up to 2 years. Yes, I do think they should. They know that they're causing massive problems and they know that they're dangerous. They too must be aware of these stories. They must stop it immediately. And yes, if they continue, anybody now arrested for doing this should go to jail. I'm really cross about it, yeah. As are many.
I think so. Just finally, Susan, of course, there was a poll just recently, I think it was a YouGov poll, which suggested, I think it was 66% of people say the tactics of Insulate Britain are damaging the cause they espouse. And if you ask people over 50, it was something like 77% of people over the age of 50 said it's damaging their cause.
Well, of course it is. I mean, and everybody I've spoken to thinks we should take a zero tolerance approach. We should. Enough is enough. These people are causing terrible, terrible problems, very serious issues, and they need to be dealt with properly.
Absolutely right. That's Susan Hall. She's the leader of the Conservative group on the Greater London Assembly. Thanks for joining us. Visit mailplus.co.uk/subscribe to get access to all our podcasts, videos, opinion pieces, and much more. If you want to get in touch, tweet us at MailPlus or me at Tory Boy Pierce. So drug users in Scotland will receive warnings from the police instead of being prosecuted. This is a major shake-up of the law. Officers will be advised to issue only a recorded police warning to anyone they catch in possession of illicit substances, which include Class A heroin and cocaine. I'm joined now by Niamh Eastwood, who's Executive Director of Release, which is the UK's leading centre for the expertise of drugs and drugs law. Niamh, this has come out of nowhere, to be honest, and it's not going to be voted on by the Scottish Parliament. Do you think it's a good idea? And if so, why so?
So firstly, what I would say, Andrew, is I'm not sure it's come out of nowhere, given the drug death task force that has been set up by the government has made a recommendation in the last month that people caught in possession of drugs aren't subject to criminal prosecution. So this reflects the evidence that's come forward from that task force. And I do think it's a good idea. I mean, at my organization, we have done research on jurisdictions across the world that have adopted this approach. And it's more than 30 countries currently that do not criminalize possession of drugs, and that's any drug. And what we find is that drug use doesn't go up because we know the criminal law is not a deterrent effect. But in fact, there are really positive health and social outcomes, and that it has the ability to reduce reoffending rates. So this is a smart approach that's being taken by the Scottish government.
So, the Scottish government has a huge problem, as we know, Niamh. Drug deaths soared to a record high last year of nearly 1,339, 3.5 times the rate of the rest of the UK. How will this policy mean fewer people are going to take drugs, and hopefully fewer people are going to die from taking drugs?
Well, I think the most important thing is working out what our drug policy should do, and I think an effective drug policy is one that reduces harms, and obviously the most egregious harm is that of someone dying. And these are people's family members. And you're absolutely right that the rates of death in Scotland are extraordinarily high. They're the highest in Europe. And if we look at countries within Europe that have taken this approach, that have decriminalized possession of drugs, including Portugal and Czech Republic, their drug-related death rates are 50 to 60 times lower than Scotland. And in fact, every country in Europe that has ended criminal sanctions or that has, if you like, depenalized drug possession offences, which is what this is, because it's still a criminal offence. What they have, and these are countries like Germany, Spain, Italy, all of these countries have a lower drug-related death rate than the EU average. And whilst you're right, Scotland has a really high rate, we shouldn't forget that England and Wales is also third highest on that really horrific league table. So this is a problem for the UK as a whole. And what we would like to see is the situation in Scotland actually being rolled out across the UK and for the UK government to actually legislate for decriminalisation of drug possession offences.
I'm still not quite clear, and perhaps I'm just being a bit dim here, Niamh, why it means there will be fewer drug deaths by no longer criminalising people caught in possession of drugs.
Well, I think, you mean, it's not just the legal framework. You know, all of the countries that I've mentioned, and Scotland as well, are investing heavily in health responses, so in treatment and harm reduction support for people who use drugs. And if you have that wraparound holistic approach, people are supported when they become drug dependent to find medical interventions to deal with that drug dependency. And if you criminalize someone, if you treat them as a criminal first and foremost, that carries a huge amount of stigma and fear of prosecution. So it means that people are less likely to come forward and get the treatment that they need. Equally, too, we have to remember that the majority of people who use drugs aren't drug dependent. 90% use recreationally. The biggest risk they face is criminalization, and that's largely young people who we are burdening with a criminal record.
But what if the person caught in possession of a Class A drug is in fact a dealer? They must be criminalized, surely. They must be prosecuted and chucked and banged up.
Well, I don't think prison works generally.
Right.
And in fact,
but they should be prosecuted, shouldn't they? A dealer.
Well, I think if we look at the reality, lots of people who supply drugs are also user dealers. I mean, this is a complex situation. Obviously, there are people who are higher up the supply chain who are committing significant negative harm to society, and they are subject to imprisonment when they are caught. But this policy that's being proposed by the Scottish government is actually just focused on people who use drugs. And the police will determine whether the person is in possession for their own personal use or whether they are supplying. And the police do this every day, every single day. They have to determine whether someone's a supplier or not with things like circumstantial evidence. So that will be looking at the quantity of drugs, the way the drugs are wrapped, if there is money on the person's in the person's possession. So that's how this will be distinguished. So this isn't, if you like, allowing people who supply drugs off the hook. It's really focused on the user. That being said, there are police forces in England and Wales that have diversion schemes, which are very similar for people who supply small quantities of drugs, and where their supply is driven by their own dependency. So this could be expanded, but that's not what Scotland is talking about right at the minute.
All right, well, that's very interesting. That's Niamh Eastwood, who's the Executive Director of Release. Thanks so much for joining us. The Daily Mail's business editor, Ruth Sunderland, here with the latest business news. Not such good news. Inflation, interest rates, Ruth, we're not looking good, are we?
No, it's not really what we wanted to hear from the Bank of England today. They have been saying, the policymakers there, that they think the recent rises in inflation that we've seen are transitory. And they've now acknowledged that perhaps they might not be quite as transitory as we would have liked. This is quite a big watershed here for the bank. What they're saying is that UK inflation is expected to rise above 4% by the end of the year. We've already seen some of that in the shape of these rising energy costs that we've been reading about. It's also scaled back its growth expectations a little bit, which is not what we really want to hear. It has the good news, such as the good news is that interest rates have been held steady at 0.1%. QE, the money printing, that's also steady at $895 billion. That's an awful lot of money printing there. And there's no immediate urgency around raising interest rates, which I suspect any of our listeners who've got a mortgage or loans are going to be most concerned about. But obviously that is going to be further and further coming up the agenda as time goes on, particularly if this inflation situation continues as it is now.
And of course, Ruth, if they do put up interest rates, that increases the debt, the repayment on the debt burden, and the debt burden is through the roof.
So we're already beginning to see that. The debt is absolutely huge overall, well over £2 trillion. That's an incredible amount of money. And we're also seeing that because some of the interest repayments are linked to inflation, the costs of that are already beginning to rise in quite a nasty way. That is a difficulty for the government. That's going to act as a real drag on the public finances, which are already in difficult shape, obviously, following the huge amounts that we've had to spend on COVID-19 support. And that's of course been coupled with the fact that tax revenues, tax receipts have been down as businesses have had their takings reduced, and that as some people have been on furlough or had slightly lower earnings. So we've seen a lot of strain really on the public purse. And in the end, that does mean you and me. There's no magic money tree there. It's us as taxpayers who are footing this bill. So it's very difficult. We've seen in the US as well, the central bank there has been really looking at interest rates. I think we do have pain to come down the line on this one, unfortunately.
All right. Well, that's the Daily Mail's Ruth Sunderland, who is, of course, business editor at the Mail. Thanks for joining us. A documentary on the life of Prince Philip showcased personal recollections from the Queen and Prince Philip's children and many other royals, including William and Harry. The documentary featured personal recollections, including the Duke's great love of barbecuing and a prank involving mustard. I'm joined now by the Daily Mail's Robert Hardman, who, of course, came up with the idea, was one of the producers and conducted the interviews. Robert, I don't think I've ever seen that many members of the royal family talking in one programme.
Well, thank you, Andrew. I think we did set a record for royal cast lists, if you like. We had in total 14 members of the royal family, and 15 if you include the Prince Bernhard of Baden, the Duke's great nephew. So we had a lot of royal voices, but you know, they all had something to say, and it was great to have them all on.
It was incredibly charming, and Tim Lawrence, Princess Anne's husband, I thought really, perhaps of all of them, seemed to get the prince most of all. Perhaps that's because he's a fellow sailor, had a distinguished career in the Royal Navy, like Prince Philip.
Sir Tim was a great asset and you know covered lots of interesting ground. But I think all the family did. Yeah. I mean, I thought it was particularly nice as well to see Lady Louise.
She was wonderful, and I think a lot of people were struck because that was her debut, if you like, wasn't it? First time she's spoken on camera. And she was so charming.
Very charming. Obviously adored her grandfather and sort of a bit of a chip off the old block, because when we went to see her, she was actually right in the middle of doing her Duke of Edinburgh's award scheme.
Was she really?
Not most of the royal family haven't actually done it. Either their school didn't do it when they went there or for whatever reason. But she's very enthusiastic about it. But what's really sweet is she's taken up carriage driving, which of course was the sport that he didn't just love, he actually invented it as a sport. I mean, it was a hobby for people.
Yeah.
And he's the person who wrote the rule book and said, right, we're going to make this a sport. And she's, she rides takes out his horses and his carriage and loves it. So she, I thought it was great to see her.
Yeah.
They all, everybody was keen to do this just because they all, they all adored the Duke.
And Lady Louise, she's, of course, Prince Edward and Sophie Wessex's daughter. And of course, we know that Sophie Wessex was quite a fan of Sophie Wessex too, wasn't he, Prince Philip?
Yeah, he was. I mean, he didn't really have favourites. I did ask them that. I said, did he have any favourites? And they all said, no. He treated everyone the same. But he was very good with people who sort of married into the family, because that, of course, is what he himself had done. And he, it wasn't an easy ride for him to start with, up against the old palace, old guard in the 40s and 50s. So he's always, made a point of helping out those who are sort of stepping into this. And that's why we heard last night, the Duchess of Cornwall saying how, she looked up to him as a sort of role model, how to be a consort. And Sir Tim touched on that himself.
Yeah.
There's no point copying anyone else. You've got to find your own way. And Sophie, the Countess of Wessex, very, very fond of him. I mean, really, because the Wessexes live very near where they live on the Windsor estate. So they see a lot of them. And it was great to see all the strands of the family in there.
And it was interesting because you got to see the what he was really like, because of course we have our image of Prince Philip, rather severe, rather stern, rather don't think he liked Fergie very much, and very intolerant with the press, and didn't suffer fools gladly. We know all that, but this showed another side of him completely, I thought.
Yeah, I think what was intriguing was the way that the family was, that they themselves were so interested and astonished by his early years, his childhood, and what a sort of bleak, almost Dickensian childhood it was, with the parents splitting up, the mother confined to a sanatorium, the sisters abroad, and he's being sort of just shuffled around different cousins and boarding schools, and it's all pretty grim. And they were very struck by that. And I think what I hope came through from the programme is that he was a very hands-on dad, but also a very hands-off grandfather. It was sort of mayhem when the grandchildren were around. And I think both sort of generations are very grateful for that.
You think of someone like that now, the upbringing Prince Philip had, they'd be in therapy.
Oh, they'd be in care, actually.
Yeah, they would, actually, because, I mean, it really was an extraordinary life. And how was the Queen?
The Queen, of course, doesn't do interviews.
No.
The one royal we were missing.
Yeah.
She's never done an interview, and she's certainly not going to start in her 10th decade, nor should she. I think it's wonderful that she still has this sort of this mystery, really. And it's served her very well. So, it was very important to have lots of archive shots of her in there just to remind people. He was at her side. I mean, this has been a record-breaking reign in almost every regard, and she would be the first to say that it wouldn't have happened without him.
Her rock and her stay. And Prince Charles, of course, too. Great to hear him talking about his pa.
Yeah, he was very sort of fond form. I mean, he's wonderfully sort of self-deprecating, the Prince of Wales. He's very good at that, and he tells stories very nicely. And he was very sad and like, well, of course they were all sad when it happened, but he's the one as the head of the family, or the future head of the family, he's the one who has sort of go out and make the statement in front of the cameras, and And you know, it was a tough few weeks for him, but he was charming.
You could see actually in his face at the funeral how emotional he was, couldn't you?
Yeah, no, he really, you know, he's an emotional man, and he definitely wanted us some time to think about it before we went down to film him, because this program started out as a 100th birthday tribute. It was this time last year that actually we first approached. I sort of rang up the palace and said, look, we want to do this. And the word came back, well, the Duke doesn't want anything to do with it.
Of course.
You know, doesn't want to blow his own trumpet, but if other people want to talk about him, well, that's up to them.
Yeah.
And of course, they all wanted to talk about him. And we'd interviewed, you know, several of them. Suddenly the terrible news dropped in April, and the whole project, we just thought, well, that's that. And then afterwards, we went back to the family and said, well, you know, what's been said so far is actually more poignant, more relevant now, in a way, than it would have been just for a birthday film. And they all agreed, and said, well, yeah, no, let's carry on. So the first person we interviewed after his death was the Prince of Wales. And he, you know, he wanted a few days to sort of think about it. But he's a very good storyteller, actually, Prince Charles, and once he started sort of telling us about sort of the time he sort of tried to light a barbecue and that wasn't a success, or his father and him having a row, and he would try to teach him how to carriage drive. But I mean, it's all they're like any other family. I mean, I think that's what came through
last
night.
No, I agree.
Everybody would have thought, you know what, that reminds me.
That could be my grandpa, or that could be my dad. Yeah. Tell us just finally, Robert, the prank involving the mustard.
Yes, yeah. The it's gone viral, actually. I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if mustard sales have gone through the roof, literally. Yeah. Because Prince William told us this story of how the Duke, when they went at family barbecues, it was his sort of party trick was to get the children to hold a tube of mustard pointing up at the ceiling and then clap their hands together so the whole thing squirted up to the roof. And Peter and Zara Phillips had the same story as well, and they were all reminiscing about this frightful mess all over the... Because they love having their barbecues, and they've got these little sort of bothies and huts and hideaways all over the estate where they go and have these barbecues. And the Queen didn't find it very amusing because she does the cleaning up. She likes to do the cleaning
up. She does. Yes,
she doesn't want any help. And of course, famously, Mrs. Thatcher once tried to help with the washing up, and the voice came, "Will someone tell that woman to sit down?" she didn't want help. So if there was mustard on the ceiling, it would be the Queen's job to clean it off again.
Yes, and she's not very tall.
Visions of her on a stepladder.
Yes,
kill it. What's this?
Well, that's a great story, and it's a great film, and a great triumph for you, Robert, too. So
thank you. It's on iPlayer, by the way. So
I have to say, can people find it? Yeah, they can find it on iPlayer, and it's an absolutely charming film, and it's a great triumph for the Daily Mail's Robert Harbin, who made it. Thanks for joining us. Well, that's all we've got time for today. For the latest from the Daily Mail, download the Mail Plus app. Every weekday at 5 p.m, you can listen to me all over again. I'm Andrew Pearce. This is The Andrew Pearce Show. I'll be back tomorrow. Have yourselves a great evening and good night.